There have been many times over the last 35 years or so when I've been speaking to people about the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. I was fortunate enough in 1969 to meet Swami Kriyananda. Lee held up these books, that's why I'm doing it again. Some of you weren't here. Swami Kriyananda is an American man, still living. He's 80. He'll be 83 in a couple of months. And he knew Yogananda personally. Yogananda's, most of you, if you haven't read this book yet, you must not leave the store without it. It's really one of the sort of foundation books for anyone who begins to think outside of the mainstream in a spiritual way. It's been published for more than 50 years, and it still regularly makes the bestseller list, which is really extraordinary. It's a great text. When Kriyananda, who was then called Donald Walters, was 22 years old in 1948, he himself read Autobiography of a Yogi, but Yogananda was still living. Yogananda lived until 1952. So Kriyananda went and became a personal direct disciple of his. And ever since then, which is now more than 60 years, Kriyananda's life has been dedicated to sharing with others the basic teachings of what Yogananda calls self-realization, which is a generic term, meaning the understanding of spirituality as something that emanates from the inside of a person and is a question merely of realization. You don't have to create it, you don't have to earn it, you don't have to be saved by anyone. You simply have to become conscious of that which we are unconscious of now, which is our true nature and how to experience more and more of what that is. I was fortunate when I was 22 in 1969 to go to a lecture at Stanford University that Swami Kriyananda was giving. And I was extremely fortunate, as I tell in that book, to have what was actually just an instantaneous recognition. Swami was 44 at the time, a younger man, certainly, just beginning what has now become the building of a worldwide spiritual work on 3 continents and 8 communities and many things, of which I've been fortunate to be a witness or a participant in all of that. So what I'm going to share with you, I say by way of background, is I'm not coming here telling you about something that I myself just noticed the other day, or that I've worked out carefully that I think are really good theories about the nature of the universe. I'm a representative of an ancient and a very noble and ultimately really very orthodox, although not orthodox in the sense that word may mean of sort of narrow fundamental interpretations of scripture, but orthodox in the sense that this tradition has been the same for thousands of years, and all the great rishis and masters of the Himalayas and of India and of all religions end up endorsing the same vision of reality. And so tonight we're specifically talking, and I'm telling you what I've learned primarily from Kriyananda, and Kriyananda learned from Yogananda. Some of what I say, I speak with their authority. Some of it I have verified with my own experience. Enough of it I have verified to be able to speak with conviction, that's for sure. In all these years, since 1969 virtually, I myself have lived in a spiritual community or in an ashram, and my work has always been to support the development of that spiritual work and primarily to share with others. For the last 22 years, my husband and I have lived here in the Bay Area and have helped develop the Ananda community for Palo Alto, and these are our magazines which we'd like to share with you. And East West is actually an enterprise inspired by Ananda. Now, having said all of that, which is by way of way big introduction, now let's go on to what we're really talking about. I want you to know that because I'm going to talk about the nature of God, which is a teeny weeny bit presumptuous. And so I wanted you to understand, you know, that there's a lot more power standing behind me than what you see. And you may dispute with me, and that's perfectly fine, and I'll tell you how I've learned what I've learned, and we can see what's true. I don't think there's anything self-evidently more important, really, than the nature of God. Many people don't care, or nowadays people have a growing longing, inner longing, for some kind of a deeper understanding of spirituality. There's an intense sense, especially lately, of extraordinary insecurity sort of creeping over us. This country has been so fortunate in our economic status and in our freedom from conflict on this soil. Even though we've engaged in multiple wars, those wars have not intruded into our home. It has not been our homes that have bombed, our cities been bombed, our cities that have been disrupted. 9/11 is fair. That's the closest thing we've had. But nonetheless, that was a singular attack. You know, a singular attack where in the morning all those people were killed, and it except for occasional interludes. But we've never, I recall it actually right after 9/11, I was part of a multi-faith gathering in the Palo Alto City Hall Center, the square there. And this young man stood up who was a student at Stanford, and he basically said, since I was 8 years old, he said, I've lived under repeated bomb attacks. I think he was from Beirut or somewhere like that. And he just talked about just a childhood that was constantly being interrupted by bombs falling on the world in which he lived. And, you know, we were all standing there in sunny Palo Alto, and even though we knew that New York had just been attacked, almost no one else in those many hundreds of people standing in the square had any experience like that boy had. And he was now a Stanford student, you know, just toodling around the campus like any other carefree youth. But his background was so entirely different than ours. And America has made good use of its good karma, I would call it, in the sense that overall we've been an extremely generous and a welcoming nation. I definitely am not blind to the faults of this country, but the fact of the matter is the world flocks to our doors. Because of the freedom of this country and the economic opportunity and the relative security. Well, lately, as you all know, there's been a sort of the rugs being has been pulled out of that sense of stability, and even as we sit here, we really don't know sort of what the future holds. A lot of people's what they thought were absolutely secure plans have proven to be insecure, and nobody really knows. And there are certain psychic and sages and prophets who have told us that this is the beginning of a very hard cycle for us. Now, the ironic thing is, of course, I've been running Ananda Temple for many years. We've been running this wonderful Sunday morning service. There's a picture of me having a very good time at it in the little temple that we have. And these crowds are getting bigger and bigger, ever since the world became less secure around us, more and more people are coming into our temple, which of course I think is a lovely thing, but of course there's nothing like, well, what should I say, the fear of God that gets you to sort of try to get in relationship to it. Because we're trying to understand now what's happening to us. And more than that, we're noticing that those things that we thought were inviolable may not be. And that makes us think. Now the difficulty that we're facing culturally, globally, is that we have a lot of confusing ideas about who and what God may be. And in fact, I know not all of you are necessarily born in America or born speaking English as your first language, but when we talk in English about spiritual things, we end up having to use the word God. People go to great lengths not to use it, but I think it's really hard not to use it. You can speak of spirit, you can speak of universal energy, and all of those things are valid. But sooner or later, there's this definite necessity to personify in some conscious in some conscious being the concept for which we use the word God in English. But the fact of the matter is that the word God in English actually has no meaning. If you just really stop for a minute and say, what does it mean? I mean, if I say coral color or scarf or skirt, we have a sort of concrete idea of what it is we're talking about. Even green, which is an abstraction, which could mean many different things. Still, we have a basic concept that when we say green, we're talking about this part of the spectrum that looks approximately like this, right? But when we say God, golly, that could mean any kind of things, couldn't it? Depends on what religion you are, what theology you have, whether you're a Christian, whether you're a non-Christian, whether you're somebody who denies that God is even there, what are you denying is existing? It gets very complicated, doesn't it? So people have all these feelings and debates about God, But I think a great deal of it is actually semantic, or you might even say the lack of clear concepts. The publishing company that published this book actually publishes both of these now. It's called Crystal Clarity. Swami Kriyananda has a principle, which is simply the principle of clarity, crystal clarity. He says a great deal of people suffering in confusion is, in life is just because the basic concepts that we're working with are not clear. And over these many years that I've referred to, which I have been offering in one form or another at the meditation retreat that Ananda runs, traveling around the country, speaking over these many years in this area, many times people come in and I'm quite comfortable as a devotee, which is meaning that a person who's devoted to an image of God, who has what could be called a bhakti nature, which is a heart-centered devotional nature. I like to chant, I like to pray. I sort of like all that feeling energy in relation to my spiritual life. So I could toss the word God around quite easily. And I'll often have people come in who will tell me, at the very least, they're agnostic, or maybe they're fierce atheists. And almost always I say, well, you know, that's perfectly fine. You know, just substitute whatever words work for you, or put your hands over your ears and make noise like that when I say the words that you don't want to hear. Because really, when people are atheists or agnostics, for the most part, what they have rejected is somebody's concept of God that either was driven down their throats when they were youth or that they came to intellectually from some book or another. But it's usually that there's some concept that they have defined as God that they find unacceptable, and they have rejected it. You know, somebody who's in charge who causes people to suffer, and how could anybody love anyone who causes people to suffer? Therefore, I'm an atheist. Any way you want to put it. And most of the time, they're justified because the concept of God that they rejected really deserves to be rejected. But the difficulty, as I say, that we're dealing with is that we don't then have an agreement, because certainly when somebody describes some monstrous being with all this power who uses it to cause people ill, and how can you believe in such a thing? Well, my answer would be, well, I don't. I would have to be pretty dumb to believe in such a thing, or evil myself, and why would I do that? Now, the tradition that I speak from of Yogananda is based in India. It's, let me phrase it differently, Yogananda himself came from India. It's really a universal tradition, but in this planet, especially at this time, for over these many, actually many thousands of years, every country on the planet has a particular national characteristic, and the different countries provide different environments for people to reincarnate in turn, or incarnate from other planets where it's suitable, that you can be part of a particular kind of culture that will orient you toward whatever it is your lessons are for this particular lifetime. And the job of America has been to be open, dynamic, free, and materially efficient. That's what we're mostly interested in. We're also a religiously oriented country, in the sense that we were founded for religious purposes. This is the only country in the world that was founded on the basis of religious freedom. And very notably, as one of my South American friends pointed out, South America was settled for acquiring gold and has been very unsettled ever since. And North America, the United States particularly, was founded for religious freedom and is the second oldest continuous government in the world. I mean, it's just solid. And until recently, we've sort of fallen a little bit on hard times, but we've been a very free nation, especially spiritually, and spiritually interested. We have so many churches in this country. When our group was acquiring this building, which we've had now for almost 17 years, this is just the sign, but we're housed in what used to be St. Aloysius Catholic Church on El Camino. It's a lovely old building. It was built about 50 years ago, like this. When we were acquiring that church, we had friends of ours from Italy who were staying with us in our house. And not all of them spoke English well, and we don't speak Italian, so there was a certain amount of translating that would be going on all the time. And we were talking about buying this Catholic church, and we were so excited we were going to have it. It was going to be an Ananda church. This was 1994. And finally at the table, there was kind of this whispered conference in Italian among our friends. I mean, like this. And finally, the good English-speaking one spoke up and said, "We do not understand this, buying a church, you know. In Italy, they never sell those churches. They just keep them forever. And even the idea that you could start a church. In America, we've called our work a church. But when we went to Italy, I mean, it was out of the question. You don't start churches. There's the church. That's it. Nobody just makes a church. Whereas in America, we just make churches right and left all the time. People are always starting churches. Anybody can start a church. And it's because of our orientation that we have this free creative spirit. We're just allowed to do that. And that's what ultimately, even though we may go through some hard times, is going to save this country. Because that's who we are and where we're going. But having said all that, still, the tradition, the role of India in America, in global evolution, so to speak, has always been, they've always been the custodian of the highest spiritual truth. Now, I'm not talking about Hinduism, which is a kind of sort of cultural development over the last few thousand years. We're talking long cycles of time here. We're talking about the great self-realized spiritual masters, primarily you might say the Himalayan masters. In fact, Autobiography of a Yogi, it's very interesting. The first sentences of this say, I could almost quote them, but I'll read them since the book's right here in front of me. The characteristic features of Indian culture have long been a search for ultimate verities and the concomitant disciple-guru relationship, is how he puts it. The characteristic features of Indian culture have long been thousands of years. So there's a worldview that comes from this ancient culture that transcends Hinduism, Judaism, Christianity, and in fact, more realistically, is the underpinning for all of them that is based not on dogma, but on the actual experience of those who have the expanded consciousness in a scientific manner, not merely to speculate about what might be true, but actually to perceive what is true. Now, all of us in our lives, in one way or another, because of our experience, have come to certain definite opinions about what is true and what isn't true in realms that are not, this is a scarf and this is a skirt, you know. For example, and maybe some of you know this from direct experience, or maybe you were born knowing it. People generally find eventually that drinking alcohol in order to change your mood, especially to rely upon alcohol as the way to cope with life, is really a bad idea in the end. Now, it may seem like a really good idea at the beginning, and maybe some of you even in this lifetime have lived through that or know people. You know, people who become addicted to consciousness-altering substances, especially consciousness-dulling substances, always think it's a good idea. You don't start out doing something like that thinking, oh, I think this is the most self-destructive thing I can think of to do. Or even if you know that this is self-destructive, you somehow believe that self-destruction is a good idea. Isn't that true? That somehow something I want will come from this. Or you may have found that perhaps being faithful to your life partner is a really good idea. That infidelity doesn't really bring you what you want, even though adultery may look like a really good idea at the time. In the end, it usually ends up causing you quite a mess. And we sort of come back to one of those Ten Commandments, one of those pesky Ten Commandments way back there at the beginning. Or stealing, or murder, or hatred, or unkindness even, or having a carping negative attitude. You know, there's all these different things that through our actual experience, we begin to develop an understanding. It's not merely a philosophy of life, in the sense that, oh, this sounds like a good idea. It's based on what we've actually experienced and perceived to be true and recognize that our own best interest, our happiness, is facilitated by these actions and thwarted by others. Isn't that so? Now, the question that we can ask in trying to understand what we're talking about here tonight, is there any sort of point at which in which experience-based knowledge is not possible? We may find limits to our experience and therefore the understanding of life we have from it, but we often, almost all of us, encounter in our lives people we can look at who see they've had more experience, more subtle experience, and therefore understand things that we only may be glimpsing, but we can really see from where we do connect sort of what the potential of that is. Does that make sense? I mean, this is what happened to me when Swami Kriyananda walked into that room. Actually, it was a tent, as it happened, but it was a tent at Stanford University where this lecture was being held. And he walked in. I was already studying the teachings of self-realization, although not through this lineage, but through a different lineage from India. And I sensed when he came into that room instantaneously that he had become what I had begun to understand was what I wanted to become. And I would have described that as filled with joy, having a certain personal power, having what felt to me like an extremely expanded consciousness. Like I couldn't feel the edges of his self. You know, most people are sort of defined. This is who we are. This is what we feel. This is what we think. I could sense that you could kind of enter into his consciousness, but I couldn't find the edges of it. And I, in retrospect, realized that the desire for self-expansion was one of the most powerful motivators in my own life. And when I met it, I was immediately drawn to it, immediately. Even though I didn't really understand how it would all work, but I had enough experience to know that he was somewhere that I was trying to go. He was farther than me. When Swami Kriyananda read Autobiography of a Yogi, in fact, when he really first looked at Yogananda's picture, he had never, ever in his life, he was a very intelligent and powerful person, even as a young man, it never occurred to him that somebody could teach him. But when he encountered Yogananda, he recognized exactly the same thing I'm describing, that here was someone who knew what he wanted to know. And Swami read this book in New York City, took a bus across America. On September 12, 1948, he met Yogananda for the first time. The first words he said to Yogananda were, "I want to be your disciple." And Swami Kriyananda writes and said, he says about himself, I never imagined I would say those words to anyone. But he saw that this man's experience had taken him to an understanding that Swami's own experience, he was pointed there, but he didn't know how to get there. So the tradition of India, and the reason that there is a guru-disciple component to that, in fact, they call it the disciple-guru component, is because the tradition of India is that it is possible for incarnated beings to expand their consciousness beyond the limits of the mind and the senses, beyond the limits of the material world altogether. These are great sages, great saints, great yogis, and in some cases, great avatars. The word avatar, I know, has become very common, having to do with the being that you create in your video games, which is an extremely unfortunate aberration of the word, because the word actually means the descent of spirit. And it means the descent of the infinity of spirit expressed through an individual body. This is a Christ-like master, a Christ, a Krishna, a Buddha, all of these different words, is an individual whose consciousness has expanded to infinity, who, for no reason except in the service of others, incarnates in human form. Now, the real teachers and the real guides of this whole planet are the beings who have a clue, you know? It's not the politicians, it's not the governors, it's not the powerful people with the guns, it's not the really brainy scientists or the really impressive academicians. All of them do have a little sphere of influence, and they stand in whatever sphere they're working in, and they look back to the people who are trying to go where they're going, and they take them with them. But everything in this apparent world is a small copy of the way the whole of the universe is organized. And so just as there are leaders in nations and cultures, as we get into more subtle realms, there are also spiritual leaders, leaders of whole nations. Yogananda and his line of gurus actually have been on this planet for a long time. They're key, and they're also key in America, helping to make this world happen the way it happens. Now, these masters in India have created over many, many thousands of years, not just centuries, but for many thousands of years, a very consistent view of human nature, human life, and the purpose of life. Really, that's what we're all seeking, whether we know it or not. We're trying to figure out, why was I born? What am I supposed to do? And primarily what we're really working with is to try to work with two realities. One is, we have an aversion to suffering, and we have a longing for joy. Isn't that so? We may use other words than joy. Bliss is a better word, but again, here we're stuck a little bit with English, because joy is not a specific word, but bliss is a better word. But even bliss can mean many things. The word ananda actually is a Sanskrit word which means bliss. But it doesn't mean the bliss of, oh, it was such a great spring day today and I got out of my work early. It's the internal, causeless, unconditioned bliss of our own nature, which actually, and I haven't really gotten to that point yet, is another word for God, but we'll get there soon. Okay? So the basic understanding that Yogananda defined, and what Yogananda did when he came to America in 1920, is he took this enormous tradition, thousands of year tradition of his own country, and he didn't bring Hinduism, he didn't bring Indian chants, he didn't bring Indian clothes or Indian food, except just a little bit in his own person. But what he brought was he simplified and brought to a clear practical focus. He said he was drawn to America because Americans wanted a simple, practical spirituality. That's what we're like, aren't we? You know, we just have a very can-do spirit. That's why we have accomplished so much, and that's why we're such a nifty country in so many ways. We just have this feeling of, oh, well, let's do it. And we cooperate together, and we figure out, and we're very practical. We make it work. And so there was this growing consciousness that the masters of India, the masters of the Himalayas, the masters of the higher spheres responded to, which is Americans wanted a simple, practical approach to spirituality. So Yogananda brought this very, relatively speaking, synthesis. And his first explanation of that was simply this. He called it the science of religion. And it is exactly what I just said. Everyone in the world is trying to escape suffering and to experience bliss. And we want a bliss that is that is not going to be subject, you know, to worm and moth and cold and heat and economic up and down turns, or health, or disease, or life or death, even for that matter. And we would like to have an understanding of where suffering comes from so that we may behave in a simple, practical way that'll turn us away from that. Now, the God of America increasingly has been money, which we have worshipped with a really admirable fervor. But unfortunately, money is not a conscious being in itself. And therefore, it can't give us something that it doesn't really have. That's the problem. If you worship something that is not in itself conscious and does not in itself have the vibration of what you're trying to achieve, no matter how devotedly you worship it, it simply doesn't have the power to respond to you. It's sort of like, you know, a little baby, a child can love a toy doll and love it intensely, but sooner or later that child has to, you know, put its affection towards sentient beings, because there has to be some capacity to respond. In a joking way, a few years ago we had to replace the carpet in our apartment, and we were doing a number of things to make it a more attractive place to live, and we decided we wanted a sort of a light golden carpet, which turned out to be very hard to find. And we finally had to order it from Georgia, and it was delivered. But this, you know how these things go. It just goes on and on. And finally, the thing was delivered, and finally it was installed. And then finally I'm looking at the apartment, and there's this gold-colored carpet everywhere. It was lovely. It was quite lovely. But, I mean, it just sat there. Do you know what I mean? I was so keen on it, but it had absolutely no capacity to love me. It was an inert object. And I'm just looking at it, trying to drink happiness from it. My friend says that the shelf life of any material object, the joy-giving capacity of a material object, he claims, is 20 minutes. I don't really know if that's scientific or not, but that's his opinion. I certainly got maybe about 7 or 8 minutes out of the rug, and then it was over. I mean, there was just nothing I could do. I lay on it, I looked at it, I felt it. I stood up close, I stood far away, and then that was that. It was just a rug. It just sat there. Okay? But the tradition of India tells us that there is, you might call, a mighty wellspring of pure bliss that is what we're actually seeking in all these other things that we seek. And the word for that is, oh, here's a great word for that. That word is called God, right? Except the wonderful thing about the tradition of India is that it wasn't an English-speaking tradition to start with. The basic tradition of India is Sanskrit. And I'm no Sanskrit scholar, and I'll never be. But there's a lot of words that exist in Sanskrit that really don't exist in other languages. And America, being so wonderfully welcoming, we're just gradually eating up those words, and sometimes we're corrupting them like Avatar. But guru, karma, chakra, those are all in pajama, jungle. These are all words we got from India a long time ago. Chai. They just come in. We're so great about this. Oh, there's a good word. We'll just, you know, wrap it up into our English language. Now, the thing about Sanskrit, like Hebrew, Latin, but Sanskrit is really the mother tongue of this planet. Most languages, or all languages, descend from it. In fact, as I heard once, somebody told me that when the space program wanted a perfect language for communication in space travel that would be absolutely unambiguous, they worked really hard to try to think about developing one and discovered finally that Sanskrit was it. That's a perfectly unambiguous language. I'm just stating this because I don't know this myself, but I have been told by scholars that that's true. But the more important aspect about Sanskrit is people who speak English have been interested in scientific and practical and materialistic things. So when we come to religion, we say God, and then we're kind of stuck. You can use the word Lord, but that could also mean the king of the ruler of the manor. It doesn't really necessarily mean a divine being. If you're Christian, you can say Jesus, Yahweh, Jehovah. But all of those words are just words. They don't have any inherent meaning. Whereas in Sanskrit, there are thousands of words that all relate to states of consciousness, because consciousness has been what Sanskrit-speaking peoples were interested in. No, we don't have exact words for the gradations of the mind and the degrees of ego identity and the consciousness that exists independently of the body and the consciousness just removed from the body and then the subtle half-aware. I mean, it just goes on and on. All these different states of meditation and the different ways in which you can orient yourself toward meditation and all the different spiritual moods and all the different ways in which the infinite power can express in our lives. So, but the thing about the Sanskrit words for God, and I'm not talking about the goddesses, Lakshmi, Shiva, Durga, which are a symbolic language in itself, which actually on Tuesday nights I'm having to be just right now giving a class on that very subject. But those are symbols created to help communicate subtle ideas. They're very subtle images, but they're not actually a word in themselves. The word Lakshmi denotes this being who has certain characteristics, and it's a symbolic representation. But the direct word for words for God in Sanskrit are words that have specific meaning. And they're words, and I'm just going to give you a few of them without burdening you. Many of you have heard the word Shanti. You may have heard the word Ananda. You may have heard the concept of Om. You may have heard of Prem. I was trying to think of a few words. Okay? Shanti means peace. Ananda means bliss. Prem means divine love. Om is the sound that you hear deep in meditation. Okay? Now, all of these words could actually be translated literally into English as God. But when you say Shanti, you're talking about an experience. And so who's going to say, I don't believe in Shanti? You may say, well, I haven't experienced it a great deal, but you're not going to reject the concept as something I don't want to have anything to do with. You know, you're not going to become an agnostic, an atheist about Shanti. I reject the concept of peace or the concept of bliss. I reject the concept of bliss. You won't, because this is who you are. This is our experience. We may lament the fact that we feel far away from it. We may doubt deeply within ourselves that we will ever have these experiences. But we won't deny their existence because we already know them. We know them in some sort of baby step, step down form. And of course, these words also have specific meaning, like in the English translation of the New Testament, Jesus speaks of the peace that passeth understanding. And that's an attempt in English to say this single word, because it's trying to explain to us that isn't the peacefulness of whew, the kids finally went to bed and now I can just put my feet up and have a beer, you know, that can be a very peaceful feeling. But, you know, in maybe a half a minute, one of those kids is going to wake up and the peace is going to be shattered. But shanti is the peace of your own inner nature that even in the midst of a concentration camp or a war, you could still be experiencing this. Because it's beyond all life and death experiences, and that's implied in the meaning of the word. And so when we start talking about God from the point of view of this, what we call the world view that has been preserved on this planet through the culture of India, the eternal verities, we're actually talking about, I'll put the word up here because it's a really good word, Sanatan Dharma. Dharma is a word that has also, you know, sort of crept into our language and isn't completely corrupted yet. Sometimes people describe the word dharma as duty or as right action. The clearest definition, dharma is that action or attitude which expands your consciousness, okay, which brings you greater awareness, which is to say that not everyone has the same dharma because it depends on where you're standing. If you're a drunk who's never done any honest work in your life and you've just been lying on the couch living off your wife's earnings or spending your own inheritance, and one day you have a great desire for a Cadillac and so you get up and get sober and get a job, your dharma is probably to get really interested in having a Cadillac because from where you were standing, that's forward, right? And so it's an expansion of consciousness to go that way. If Mahatma Gandhi, halfway through his efforts to liberate India from the British rule, decided, gee, I'm a world-famous figure. If I just opened a law office now, I'd get lots of money. Everyone in the world would consider that he had gone backwards in his dharma because where he was standing, that was not an expansion of consciousness. So it's an extremely wonderful and subtle word that duty doesn't convey. It also simply means truth, and Sanatan means eternal. I think there's an extra A in here somewhere, maybe in there. There's lots of A's in that word. Eternal truth. And Hinduism is a word that's been imposed on India by the English. They called their own teaching Sanatan Dharma. They didn't call it even a religion. It was just the way we're made. And the way we're made is that we have a deep inner longing for perfect love and for perfect bliss, and everything we do is based on that, just as I was saying, to get away from suffering, to get into everlasting peace. And everything about the practice of yoga and all the Indian teachings is Sanatan Dharma based on that simple reality. Now, in the tradition of Sanatan Dharma, they speak of the fact that the spirit manifests in the world, God manifests in the world, in 8 specific ways. And that those 8 manifestations of God, which you may recognize as the topic, which I hadn't forgotten, okay, but really all of this is the way to appreciate this. These 8 manifestations of spirit make the concept of God very specific. Just like people will say, oh, you want to be a channel for God, you want to be in tune for God, you want to express God, I want to be an instrument of spirit, all these words that people use. But they're difficult abstractions, aren't they? And they often lead to a kind of lack of crystal clarity about exactly how in any moment I'm supposed to be able to do that. And sometimes they lead to a kind of affected way of being. When Ananda first started, we were in 1969, Swami Kriyananda was starting the first Ananda community, which is now this beautiful place called Ananda Village up near Nevada City. It has a marvelous retreat, it's fabulous. I lived up there for about 16 years. And when we first started, it was the late 60s, people were coming for all sorts of reasons. We were not what else was happening, but that wasn't always clear. And also, we did not have a mature understanding collectively as to what it meant to be a spiritual person. And there was this one woman who she would always wear white, and she carried Yogananda's, it was a small book, but it was this little book, you know, like a little prayer book, and she would kind of walk like this, and you know, and if everything got a little too hectic, she would open her book and look at it like this. Like this. After a while, poor girl, she had a complete nervous breakdown because I think to maintain that was just so difficult for her. After her nervous breakdown, She dyed her hair. She sort of put on weight. She started speaking in a rather raunchy manner. And she was marvelous. You know, she was just so much more of everything that I would call spiritual than she had been when she was this person, like this. But, you know, this was like her some idea somewhere. Now, when we get into the eight manifestations, we avoid those problems. So I'm going to now just write up what they are, and then we'll talk about each one. Love, peace, bliss, calmness, which is different than peace, power, which is more easily understood as energy, wisdom, light, and sound. Now, as I mentioned to you, I've been following these teachings for many decades, and I've taught many, many aspects of this path, and this is one of the most useful and most fundamental ideas, if you can get this in your head, on an everyday practical level in terms of figuring out how to deal with your life, what to do next, how to avoid suffering and find bliss. So let me begin to sort of say how this works. Now, the thing about this is, there are other, you know, subsidiary qualities people ask. Well, what about contentment? What about forgiveness? What about kindness? What about compassion? I mean, all of those are qualities. But the subtlety of this is that everything else is encompassed through here. The other aspect about these different qualities, and we'll go through them one at a time, is that in every circumstance, pretty much, you can hook onto one or another of them. You know, so that, and if you begin to understand that the power of the infinite, God or whatever you want to call it, this is how God manifests in this world. And if you want to be part of that story, you simply have to get into one of these vibrations and begin to put it forth. So there's never a time when you have to feel that I have nothing to do, right? Or nothing I can do. Now, love is obvious. You know, we tend to know what that means. We can come back to it in a moment. Peace is the inner sense of stillness that can come to us when we cease to worry, we cease to think. This is a state of meditation. Or many people, you feel, you get up really early in the morning and you walk through your dark house and you just go down and fix yourself a cup of tea. Often at those little transition points, there's this very deep sense of peace that we can touch into. Now, the distinction between peace and calmness is a very interesting one, because peace is something that requires a kind of cessation of activities or cessation of inner activities for you to feel this. But many times in our lives, our situation is anything but peaceful. And I was just talking to Greg and a few others before we started. I've been working for the last 3 weeks helping to make costumes for this big production that our Living Wisdom School do. And our school is 4-year-olds through 13-year-olds, so it's 60 children of many ages. And it's been fun, that's for sure. It's taken a lot of energy and a certain amount of wisdom to put the thing together. And I've loved doing it, but it hasn't been real peaceful. Let's just put it that way. You know, you have these 60 children and they're tugging at your skirts and where is my costume for the battle scene and what am I gonna do and how am I gonna change out of this and how can I be a beggar today and then a queen tomorrow? You know, just like it's anything but peaceful. But you see, I can remain very calm in the midst of it. Not that I always have, but I could remain very calm in the midst of it. You could be on the middle of a battlefield. You could literally have a gun in your hand and just be trying to get to point A to point B without getting killed and getting your men or your women through with you. And you could, there's no peace anywhere. There's not much love. You might not even be enjoying yourself very much, but you could be very calm. And so in the midst of whatever may be falling apart around you, this manifestation of spirit is still an option for you. You see what I mean? Or you might be in a very unhappy mood. Nothing is really working very well for you. But you can always put out energy. And this is in my own life. Sometimes I used to be subject more to moods and just sort of periods of disinclination to want to do much. Or I'd get mad about something and just didn't want to act properly. But I could put out energy. And sometimes I'd only put out that energy like, oh, I have a huge... Well, when I was writing this book, and it took me a couple of years to really get grounded in it. So I couldn't really work on this sometimes, which really took away my bliss. So I'd wash the dishes, right? Because it was better, if I couldn't grab anything else, I would at least put out energy. And energy, power, energy, is an aspect of the way God manifests in this universe. And so you just start putting out energy, and even if I just start washing the dishes, once I start putting out energy, instead of just lying on my bed like an inert thing and not doing or feeling anything, I start getting into a higher vibration. And as soon as I get into that higher vibration, the way it usually works for me, I begin to put out energy, and then good ideas come to me. I don't, maybe writing ideas, if that was my dilemma, but my native wisdom begins to act. And it says, boy, it certainly feels better just washing the dishes than it did just lying on your bed feeling like a complete schlump, didn't it? And so maybe I still can't go where I really need to go, but, well, we need some groceries anyway, so I'll go out and get